Good morning, everyone. My name is Nathan Benares, and I'm on the organising committee for this year's Financial Services Forum. And I have the pleasure today of introducing to you Michael Rice, who will be giving a presentation on the age pension, following his paper, The Age Pension in the 21st Century, which is an update on one that he did 20 years ago. So, I was 8 at the time. So Michael's certainly showing his age, and perhaps I'm showing mine. So Michael, for those of you who don't know, he specialises in providing strategic advice to financial institutions, fund managers, government agencies, industry associations and large superannuation funds. Michael's the CEO of Rice Warner, which he founded in December 1987. So that's another date that's a long time ago, before I was born. He heads up Rice Warner's public policy work. Michael's undertaking pioneering research into the age pension dependency and trends. He has a keen interest in the integration of social security and superannuation, as well as measuring the adequacy of retirement incomes. Michael was chairman of QSuper's investment committee from January 2009 to June 2013, and remained an independent investment expert on the committee until March 2016. He is a former counsellor of the Actuaries Institute. Michael is also a member of the advisory board of the ANU College of Business and Economics. He was appointed to the State Plus board in October 2016. Michael is convener of the Actuaries Institute's Public Policy Committee, and you may recognise him as he was awarded Actuary of the Year for 2017. On that note, before Michael begins his presentation on the age pension in the 21st century, he'll be doing a short presentation of an award for the recent Actuaries Institute Public Policy Essay Competition. Would you all give a warm welcome to Michael?
Thank you, Nathan. So, yes, as convener, I have the pleasure of awarding the prize. We had quite a few, 8 or 9 high-quality essays from actuaries under age 35, and the winner who wrote about how government could analyse and target their expenditure better, which is fitting given what I'm about to say today, is Hugh Miller, and I'd like him to come up and receive his prize. Well done. Thank you very much, Hugh. Thank you. Okay. Firstly, 70% of people, Australians, are going to receive an age pension benefit during their retirement. Some will receive a full pension, some will get a part one due to means testing. Some will start with no pension, move to a part pension, and maybe after spending their retirement benefit, they might end up on a full pension later in life. So while the system clearly acts as a suitable safety net, it's questionable whether it's been structured equitably and efficiently. So what I want to do today is to go through some of the anomalies in the system and highlight areas where we could target improvement. So I, as Nathan said, I wrote about the age pension system 20 years ago. Not sure I'll be here in 2038, but you could perhaps do that one. And I'm going to have a look at how it's changed over the last 2 decades. I've got statistics which highlight some inequities and inefficiencies against a background of an ever-changing super system. I then look at the future and suggest areas which would benefit from reform. And the Institute's website's got the full paper if any of you are interested. So we all know about the three-pillar system. It's been with us probably since the late 80s, the World Bank in 94 suggested similar systems for global pension markets, and they've made a few refinements since, but broadly we comply. So the means-tested age pension provides a minimum standard of living. You could argue that it's both a safety net for those who haven't saved enough for retirement, and it's a supplementary benefit for those who've not saved enough to be comfortable in retirement. The benefit's paid from consolidated revenue, so it's not pre-funded. So there is a little bit of intergenerational spending if you have a cohort such as the baby boomers all coming through at once. The second tier, compulsory savings through the SG, as we all know, applies to wages or any income from personal exertion, currently 9.5% collected by employers which select the default fund. And that's legislated to grow to 12% by July 2025. And the interesting thing here is the dynamics of a much larger contribution change the relativities between the age pension and the SG system. When the original SG, or even before that, the award system of the mid to late 80s was 3%, it was very common for Paul Keating and others to tell workers that the benefit was additive and they'd get the age pension as well. Of course, today that's not the case. Someone with a career of 12% will be right in the middle of the means-tested territory. And then the last tier, you all know about voluntary contributions, and these are much lower than they have been in the past as the government realised that the value of most of them went to the top two deciles of both income earners and the wealthy by assets, and though curbing them tended to take make the overall concessions more equitable. Although you could argue that people in the bottom deciles get a very valuable age pension, the top they still get some value, and perhaps the middle three tiers, 40 to 60% of the people who now get squeezed. Now, the age pension has been stable in many aspects, but the growth in life expectancy for the elderly, which is, I think, about 50% in the last 40 years, and the increasing number of retirees that reach the eligibility age means that the costs have blown out in the last 20 years. The government's done a few things to look at that. As you saw in 94, they increased the female age from 60 to 65, and they did that over 20 years, which meant that no one noticed. And when I talk later about including the family home, I think that's one of the tactics. If you do it for people who are 15 years away from retirement, you've got a better chance of getting it through. Certainly don't want to touch anyone who's already retired. There are too many voters amongst them. Now, the eligibility age is going to be increased again, so it started going up and it'll be 67 by January 2024. It's also government policy to move it to age 70 by 2035. So the projections in this paper are based on age 67. But it does show you that we've got a good lever here to reduce costs by constantly increasing the eligibility age. The trade-off, though, is can you keep people employed up to age 67, even let alone 70? So back in 98, as Nathan said, I wrote a paper. I think it's still available if anyone wants to read it. Most of those comments, I think, are still valid today. However, as I mentioned earlier, super benefits are now supplementing or replacing the age pension rather than being additive. If someone had a full career at 12%, they'll start with a part pension or possibly none at all if they make extra contributions to the end of their career. So we would expect a shift from full pensions to part pension over time, and that means it's more important that we get the means testing right. And I should say that Anthony Asher and John DeRaven have a paper just on that subject at tomorrow, of those of you interested in this topic further. So the paper in 98, not necessarily my ideas, but collating what was available from a number of sources, looked at what should be the basis for setting this major part of our welfare system. And we looked at social objectives, equity, and the quantum of the benefit. And while they all seem reasonable, and certainly governments do their best to try and get these right, there isn't actually an objective for the age pension itself. Now, I know the government's trying to get an objective for the superannuation system, and the FSI recommended that over 4 years ago. It's still stuck in the Senate. But that statement, which I think was to replace or supplement the age pension with income in retirement, doesn't really say what the age pension should be. And we've never really had a debate about whether it's sustainable, whether it's appropriate, the level it's pegged, whether it's targeted properly. It's simply a building block in a very complex system. And I think we do need occasionally to review. Now, the quantum has bounced around over time, but it's usually expressed as a percentage of male average earnings, even though most recipients of the pension are female. It settled at about 27.7% of MTAWE, which is the generally accepted ABS measure of wages. That's for a single pensioner, and then a couple combined get 50% more than that, recognising that their costs are not double a single person's. And then there are all sorts of ancillary benefits, like difference in the means testing for renters and homeowners, and supplementary benefits like energy supplements and the like. So it's quite a complicated system. And if you're a military serviceman or woman, you actually get paid your pension by the Department of Veterinary Affairs, and your eligibility age is 5 years earlier than for everyone else, even though everything else about the benefit is the same. So let's have a quick look at what's changed in the last 20 years. The proportion receiving the population, the age pension's fallen slightly, not as much as you would think given the growth in superannuation balances and the increase in the eligibility age. The Harmer review was the one that said single pensioners didn't earn enough, and so they pushed it from 25%, which had been quite common for a long period of time. Then we had the 2006-07, the famous tax-free pension budget, which went a bit overboard and certainly simplified the system but gave too much away in concessions. 10 years later, they had to be clawed back in for the most part. And then we had the objective for super itself. Now, in this time, we've also had major changes to taxation. At the start of this period, we had the superannuation surcharge on contributions for high-income earners. That disappeared. But more recently, it's been replaced with Division 293, which is just a more efficient way of collecting the same money. There's now no practical difference between lump sum and pension payments. You can actually draw, once you're over 60, you can draw tax-free from either an accumulation or a pension account. And the pension accounts are limited to putting money in the pension transfer balance of $1.6 million. Now, that's to try and curb people who, based on the Casello reform, were able to pump large amounts of money into super. And, of course, the concessional contributions are now at $25,000, are a quarter of what they were 10 years ago. The other thing that's happened is that the franking credits have been identified as an incredibly valuable part of the system, and particularly in SMSFs, there's been a shift to people owning listed Australian equities, particularly companies that have a good dividend stream, fully franked, and they get that benefit. And as you know, Labor is got that one under threat. And the main reason for that is that benefit's grown, I think, from $500 or $600 million in 2002 when it was introduced to about $5.5 billion today. So you can see that, as with most things in super, changes are made because of the costs rather than the long-term policy. Now, to look at the value of the age pension, you can see that the modest lifestyle, as based on ASFA's 65-year-old homeowner, the age pension provides most of that income by itself. So you don't need very much superannuation to live modestly in retirement. And you shouldn't live in poverty, other than the fact that this is based on a homeowner. And as we'll see later, people who rent are often in dire straits in retirement. The comfortable lifestyle as set by ASFA requires a significant increase in superannuation, and it's a bit of a catch because the more you pump into super, the more likely you'll be affected by the means test, and then that means you can't just collect one for one. You've actually got to get above the means test threshold as well. The value of the pension for a married couple aged 65 now exceeds $800,000. You can make it anywhere between probably $750,000 a million, depending on your discount rate. The single person's value is certainly over $500,000. And by contrast, the median superannuation benefit for people retiring last year was less than $200,000. So this is far more than welfare. This is giving people a very generous benefit throughout their retirement. And to see how it's impacting on our costs, a century ago, only 49% of men reached pensionable age, 65. Disease, war, all sorts of things managed to knock them off earlier. And then they lived for 11 years. So the cost was not great to government. Today's generation will see 90% of newborns today, or even youngsters at university today, will get to the pensionable age, 94% of women perhaps. And both men and women retiring today will live on average more than 20 years, double what they did a century ago. So you can see the weight of numbers getting here and the longer longevity in retirement is putting quite a burden on government costs, far beyond what they expected. And if you look at the latest budget, you'll see that the aged pension and related services, including aged care, about $70 billion a year, growing quite substantially. The cost of the pension itself is growing about 4.5% a year. Combination of things, it's indexed to wages, not CPI. The growing cohort of Australians, the baby boomers coming through, and improved longevity. Cost of DBA pensions is in decline because most of them were from the Second World War or even the Vietnam War, and the numbers are smaller. Aged care is expected to grow by Treasury by about 7.5% a year, which is well above inflation. And together, these costs add up to about 3.8% of GDP. Now, when you look at the means test, the biggest change came in January last year when they scaled back the means test quite significantly. If you look at the blue line, you'll see that more older pensioners have moved to a full-age pension. And if you look at the middle line, there's a reduction in part pensioners at all ages. And then more people are removed from the age pension at older ages. This is an outworking of the fact that there were a few hundred thousand people affected. Some lost a pension, others gained a part pension. But it wasn't particularly well targeted, but it did definitely drop the or curb the increase in the pension that would have happened before. Now, one of the reasons why people are getting wealthier in retirement is the strong investment performance of our super system over an extended period of time. I think the balanced funds have had a 5% real return for 25 years. So the modern MySuper products, and that of course gives you significant wealth just through the markets themselves. Super is already 133% of GDP. It'll rise to about 190% in 20 years, and then if we continue with these high rates of return, we'll push more people into part pension or off the pension altogether. And then the projections show, and again, this is based on a retirement age of 67, not 70. The red line shows the decline in the percentage of people receiving a pension. And that's a good trend because it shows people are wealthier at retirement. The number of full pensioners falls, which is the blue line, and the part pensioners, the line beneath it, rises. And they meet in 20 years, and they're about 28% each. So you could say the balance, 44% of people will be self-sufficient and not entitled to a pension. And that's well above the numbers that have been shown in previous Treasury IGR reports. So, what does that all mean? Well, we've done some projections. We've actually gone out 80 years, but I have to say they get a bit rubbery the further you go. And I'm sure the rules will change if they look too obscene at those ages. But many young people today often say the age pension won't exist at all. The previous chart shows that while it's going to be curved back, it's still going to be there for probably the majority of Australians for some time. The cost was about 2.9% of GDP 20 years ago, and the first IGR report in 2002 projected that it would go to 4.6% in 2042. So clearly things have improved significantly. Today it's about 2.7% of GDP, and our figures show it'll drop to about 2.5% in 2038. And that gives the government quite a lot of leeway to either improve aged care or to other facilities for the elderly, or pay off the debt, any of the things that they could do. So I've looked at a few areas for reform, and this one comes up from time to time. The Productivity Commission looked at it about 3 years ago. One of the critical things you'll notice is that the treatment of renters and homeowners is quite inequitable relative to each other. So it's a valid question about how do we treat the home in the age pension means testing. 30 years ago, following quite a stable period of about since the war, the average home price in capital cities in Australia was about 2.5 times annual average earnings. And then it started blowing out. Till today, it's 8 to 12 times. So you could argue that there's a significant investment component in family homes, which is not treated. It's a tax-free asset. And it distorts behaviour. The 2.5 times, incidentally, is about $200,000, which is actually the difference in the means test between renters and homeowners. So the nominal value, if you like, is 30 years out of date. And if you look at the rent assistance, you know, $6,000 for a couple who are only earning $35,000 if they're on a full pension, it's not a lot for them to live comfortably. And renters pay a significant part of their pension just for accommodation. They don't really have a lot after that. Now, you'd say, well, why? How would we introduce this? And the government gave us a bit of a clue in the budget. They've expanded the pension loan scheme, which is actually a federal government reverse mortgage scheme. It's got an interest rate of 5.25%, which they haven't changed in 20 years. It's quite a stable scheme. I'm sure the Reserve Bank makes profit out of that interest rate. But it's what it means is that if you were to count the pension, I think if you did make a change like this, you'd move it forward 10 or 15 years so that people would be prepared for it well in advance. But if you made this change, you would find some people who are living in a big house and they don't actually have very much income. And of course, they're going to sit there on a government pension funded by taxpayers, and then they're going to leave this house tax-free to their kids, who may well be retired by the time they get the money. So we've just got to say, we don't have death duties, we don't have capital gains on housing. Have we created something that's distorted far too much in favour of the homeowner in retirement? And if you set the thresholds high enough, you're not talking about everybody's home coming into the tests. You would increase the thresholds. So it's certainly my opinion we should try and work out how we could build that in, and we should do modelling on what it would mean. Another area for reform is incentives for part-time work. You know, one of the issues of raising the eligibility age to 67 and possibly 70 is that people don't currently work to those ages, apart from Rupert Murdoch and Warren Buffett and a few people like that, but most of us don't. And if they could get part-time work, it would insist, you know, they'd be able to defer spending on their pension And it would give them an ongoing interest in a useful activity, which is also useful for elderly people. But this is going to require a shift in societal thinking to create the right environment for employing the elderly. But what is the point of telling someone that they've got to get the pension at 67 and they're a bricklayer, say, and their back goes at 55 and we pay them a disability support pension for 12 years because they're not eligible? So we're really not good at moving people properly through this system. The other area that I think we should look at is the cost of aged care, because while the pension costs look as if they're falling, aged care costs are growing significantly. And the government has funded a high level of home care packages in this budget. I think one way of addressing this is for the government to have a target for aged care and the aged pension cost combined. So if you held it at the moment, as I said earlier, they're about 3.8% of GDP. If you held them at a figure of 4, maybe 4.5, if you were generous, then once you have a target, then it's much easier for the government to play the rules within the target thresholds, targeting people who need more. But at the moment, they don't have a long-term target, so everything they do is really reactionary. And aged care costs are a significant impost, and they will one day probably outrise the cost of the aged pension, particularly if we don't liberalise the means test. So just to sum up, a couple of future policy initiatives. I think we should include more valuable homes in the means test. And one way of doing that is you could add to the current assets, if you wanted the aged pension to be a safety net, you add, say, 500,000, which is about 6 times annual earnings, to the current tests. A couple with less than the current 350, it would be less than 850,000, would then not get a pension. Now you might say that's too harsh. If you only want 40% of the population to get a pension, though, then you would increase that threshold by, say, 850,000, more like 10 times the average earnings. And what you would be doing is sending a message to people that the value of their home is important, but only if it's above average. You know, if they live in a unit somewhere, they won't be affected. But if they live in a mansion, then they're going to have to recognise that they can't get that tax-free capital gain and welfare from the taxpayer as well. And then finally, the level of rent assistance, you know, $3,500 a year for a single person and $6,600 for a couple, is really pitiful. And if I said to you that the biggest group of poverty in Australia are single renting females in retirement, you'd realise that this is a group that we would all intuitively say should be looked after, but because we don't analyse the stats enough, and you know, we're all actuaries, we tend to develop products for people who've got plenty of money like ourselves, we are in danger of having a system that has all of the building blocks to be a good one, but is in fact badly targeted in some areas. Thank you. Good.
Got some time for questions, so remember that you can send them via your mobile, via SMS. Well, I might kick off while people on the floor get themselves organised. Michael, you talked about a lot the age pension and about it being a safety net. You also put up a really interesting chart that showed, contrary to the 2010 intergenerational report, you think that the age pension as a percentage of GDP is actually going to maybe fall. So why do you think that the age pension should be a safety net? And on top of that, do you think that politicians will actually do it, given they might not have that same pressure that's been forecast previously?
Yes, I think firstly, I think it would be wrong of us to have an opinion on whether it should be a safety net only or something better. I think we should, you know, analyse the pros and cons of both. If it's a safety net, then would it cost us any less if we then had to pay other forms of welfare for people who didn't have enough money? So I think it will probably always be supplementary as well, but it's undefined. You know, if you were a young person trying to save for retirement, how could you work out what you need when you see how often the rules change on both the age pension and super taxes? And I've said before that I think the brand of superannuation is actually tarnished, even though it's clearly the best form of saving for retirement, because the layperson thinks it's a rip-off. You know, it's bizarre. It's because it changes every year.
Oh, we've got a question from the audience. I think there's a microphone just behind.
Michael, the social security system's being wound back all around the world because countries are getting older, high percentages of people over retirement age. Australia's a young country, we don't have that problem yet, but it will come. I guess I'm interested in the social pressure from the young people who are paying taxes to pay for age pensioners. In some countries, the young people seem to understand what's going on. In Australia, what's going on is the young people will pay for the current generation of older people, but when they themselves get to benefit from it, it will probably disappear or at least be reduced in amount. So what do you think of the failure of the intergenerational transfer in Australia?
Well, I wonder if it's as big a failure as we think, because back when the first IGR report came out, they said the pension would go from 2.9 to 4.6, and in fact it's fallen and will continue to decline. So And when you look globally at what people pay on pension systems, it's not uncommon to have 7 or 8% of GDP. I think David might have some more figures for us in the next session. But the system's affordable. My quibble with it more is that it's not well targeted. You know, that's really the challenge, to present better value for more people.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions that have been sent through via SMS. Michael, the pension loan scheme, which you mentioned in your presentation, it seems to be more generous for the wealthier. It's an extra 150% of age pension compared to full pensioners who only get an extra 50%. Is this fair? And should we all be able to access the extra 150%?
I don't know why there's a limit. If the loan is secured on property and the LVR is set at the right level, then anything that helps people spend more money in retirement because their assets are illiquid has got to be sensible. But there probably should be some limit. The bigger question there is, do we want a national reverse mortgage system, or should it be operated by the private sector? But I think the private sector has shown they don't really want it. They don't like the risks that go with it.
And another one, Michael, did the projections that you showed allow for potential behavioural changes due to the new very high asset test taper rate?
Not really, because the behavioural change is already built in. So we do monitor what changes over short periods of time. I wonder, given the amount of people that now see an accountant because they have an SMSF or a planner, where the behavioural change will become more prevalent in future. But I think it's anecdotal that somebody games the system, spends their $1 million or puts it into a bigger house 5 years before they retire so they can get a full pension. But, you know, if they had a family trust and source of income that's not recorded in their own name, maybe they could do that. I don't know if it happens widely. People don't like paying tax, though, so you imagine that there'll be people trying to do it.
Do you have any thoughts on the reasonable basis for valuing the family home for Centrelink purposes?
There are certainly land values that all the state governments provide, and you could probably have a proxy by the type of construction and the number of bedrooms and the like. I'm sure you could come up with some approximation. You don't really need to know the value accurately, provided that you, obviously for the pension loan system, you want to make sure that you never borrow too much to run out of, you know, so that the debt ever becomes more than the loan. But for the family home, I think as long as it's broad, you know, broadly accurate, it doesn't really matter. Remember, you're only trying to capture the ones above the threshold anyway.
You mentioned in your presentation that there's aged pension costs which are going to be flat or falling, and then there's this rising aged care cost. How would your recommendation of a total aged cost target interact with the states, and who would pick up much of the non-pension costs?
Yes, well, that just introduces another complexity, I think. But we do need to have a target. How it's then implemented, really hopefully less bureaucratically than some things we've seen. But I think if the government had a target, after all, it, funnily enough, has a target for the amount of GDP it should spend on defence every year, but it doesn't on social security. Sure, unemployment benefits are very volatile, but pension benefits should not be. They should be easily calculated and funded, really.
I imagine the defence target comes from our ANZUS treaty, but the US politicians are probably much less likely to try and give us a social care target.
They are.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Well, thank you very much for your time, Michael, and thank you for the very insightful presentation. And we also have a small gift here for you.
Okay. Thank you, Matthew.
Later.
Sure you'll drink this with me.
Thank you.